Hello and welcome to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson, a podcast for those seeking the ultimate in wine, food, and travel. Each week, she interviews winemakers, chefs, celebrities, and a variety of guests that shape the way we enjoy life.
Hi, Ilona Thompson with Palate Exposure. I'm here with Jason Lady, who is a sales manager and brand manager for the famed Cliff Lady Vineyards. We're here to get to know him and talk a little bit about the brand and also to taste some fantastic wines that are lined up in front of us. I'm very excited about all three. And we'll begin with his personal story. Where were you born, Jason?
So I was born in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada, which for those who don't know where Alberta is, for your listeners that aren't aware, that's sort of above Montana in the western part of Canada. So Edmonton is one of the more northern cities in that province, and so I think we're mostly known for our winters, and I get a lot of jokes about that when people ask me where I'm from, and when they've been to Edmonton before, they are like, how do you live there? But it's a beautiful place, and you know, I really loved growing up there. I spent the first 21 years of my life living there, and if it weren't for the wine opportunity that my dad started, I'd probably still be there. So it's a great place to grow up. I still have family there. My wife's from there, and we head back at least a few times a year to see everybody. So had a really nice childhood up there.
Yet we're still not hearing Canadian accent. Is that coming?
Yeah, it may be Western Canada is not necessarily the Eastern accent, which is typically associated with Canadians. Okay. That's where you get more of the R's and the oots. that said, something might pop out. I think it's the O sounds. That's typically what people call me out on is when we say, you know, the O words.
Got it.
But yeah.
So you moved to Napa which year?
So I moved to Napa full time in 2015, sort of midway through. So I'm just about, 4 years living here full time. But I started coming down here shortly after my dad bought the property. And then, 2005 summer, 2006 summer, 2007 came out again to work, in the cellar for the summer, and then ended up staying through the harvest season that year. And that's kind of when I knew that I wanted to be here. So what I did was I ended up applying to schools and transferred to the University of San Francisco. And I was there all through 2008, 2009, and then went and worked another harvest in another part of the world, and then ended up back in Canada. So I've kind of hopped back and forth between here and Canada, Edmonton, my hometown, over the last, 10, 15 years now. It's been jumping around. So yeah, it's nice to be finally settled here.
Yes. So throughout the years when you first started, first of all, when your dad first bought the property, like, what were you thinking at the time? It's like, what is that about? Or were you a little surprised?
I was 16 and, I was still young to where I obviously knew what wine was. My dad was a wine collector, so I always knew that it was this thing that he was in love with.
Yeah.
But in terms of going down to Napa and buying a vineyard and just making a total career change at that point of his life, it was definitely really different and unexpected. And, he always had this dream of owning a vineyard, but it was a dream. That's what it was. And he had a, successful career and just loved wine and wanted to pursue it. So for me at that age, I thought like, this is kind of crazy. Honestly, I just thought it was really odd. And I guess I suspected he would split more time between Canada and the US, but, as it's been now over the last, 17 years that we've been out here, he's really just dedicated himself to being here. So it's nice. It's nice to, like I say, to be also settled in and kind of have a family member who's now created at least a little bit of a reputation for us out here, and we can continue to grow that.
Oh, just slightly.
Yeah.
Reputation is definitely something to discuss in a separate segment.
Sure.
So you said you came, when you first started coming here, when your dad bought the property, you worked in the cellar, you kind of did different type of jobs around the property,
right? It was, like many second generation or third generation, really anybody who wants to work in the family business, you're always encouraged to work from the bottom up and do every job in every part of the business to learn it wholly. And you know, for me, those first few summers, it was spending time in the cellar, in the cave, whether it was racking wines or, you know, just basic cleanliness, things like that, cleaning the drains. You know, the property at that point in time, we didn't have the winery where we're sitting right now. This was completed for the harvest of 2005, but summer of 2005 it was still being built. So I remember we were doing lab work in trailers, and we just had, you know, a really basic rudimentary setup, but it was a great way to just develop that camaraderie with our winemaking team at that time. And spent a lot of time in the vineyard. One of the funny roles that still to this day I'm not sure if it's entirely something that wineries do year to year, but they had me go and count clusters. So I mean, it's good data to have, I don't deny that, but I was kind of like, you know, I was doing this in June and it's a little early to be out there. I guess it gives you an idea of what your crop could be. But I remember just being out in the vineyards, picking random rows and just picking random vines and counting how many clusters were on that vine and recording that. So for a Canadian guy, I thought this was great. You know, I was out there in a t-shirt and shorts, and you know, every once in a while, one of the vineyard guys would come by and he'd be in, like, you know, a hoodie and obviously, you know, protecting himself from the sun. But being the Canadian, I was just like, I'm going to get this sun while I can.
Get me some suntan.
Yeah, spend a lot of time in the vineyard and, you know, just doing those really kind of basic jobs around the cellar. And then when I got into 07, the harvest, it was, you know, doing everything, you know, from working with the wine press, you know, digging out tanks, sorting fruit, you know, again, just in the cave, stirring barrels. Like, you just do a little bit of everything. Every once in a while, they'd take me out to the vineyard on a sampling run, and that was always the best part because you'd get to see all these awesome properties, not only on our estate, but the other properties that we work with around Napa, and taste the fruit, and just, you know, I'm sure you've tasted fruit that time of year. It's just explosive how delicious it is. And that was really cool. That was a really formative year for me. So haven't looked back since.
So you were a teenager, really. And this is trial by fire. I mean, most teenagers at that age, you know, they don't wind up doing, you know, very involved vineyard work and just being so engaged. Were you loving it? Or were you like,
you know, counting clusters, again, I tried to make the most of it by working on my tan. You know, I've also really been a big music person for a long time, and I just remember I'd put playlists together on my iPod and I just put the headphones in and I'd go out there, and so I got to listen to a lot of music. In terms of, like, you know, really being fully engaged with the whole winemaking process, that didn't come until 2007. Mm-hmm. That didn't come until I'd actually worked the full vintage. Prior to that, I thought it was really cool to have an opportunity to live in California and to just experience a different place. And I'll be honest, I thought, you know, at 17, when I first started coming out here, I thought, like, California, wow, there's going to be beaches and there's going to be, like, you know, what most people probably think of, you know, San Diego or something like that, you know, or LA. And I came out to Napa and it's this farming community, you know, really small town feel. And I was just like, oh my gosh, like, this is not what I expected at all. But, you know, I thought it was really cool just to be down here, and it exposed me to all of the things that make Napa great. The food, the people, you know, craft beer. Again, I was, you know, 17, 18, my dad was cool with me having a beer once in a while. So, you know, having craft beer for the first time, where that was just not really a thing in Canada. It's there now, but it just wasn't at that point in time. So all of those experiences just introduced me to how great this valley is. I mean, the produce, you can go to the, you know, your garden and pick the best tomato you've ever tasted right off your own garden. Like, that's just, it's not that we can't grow that kind of thing in Canada, it's just, it's not the same level. Like, the everything out here is just amazing. So that's kind of initially how I really fell in love with it. I would look forward to coming out here and just enjoying all of that, and then caught the wine bug eventually. You know,
do you have brothers and sisters?
I have an older sister, and she would come down with me in those earlier years as well, and that was probably another reason why I didn't go crazy, was I actually had someone to hang out with, and I think it actually helped us grow even closer, because, you know, we didn't have any friends down here. We didn't know anybody. And so we kind of had to hang out and, you know, we'd go to movies or whatever and just kind of experience Napa, just the two of us. So she didn't catch the wine bug like I did. She still enjoys wine and everything like that, but I don't think she had the same, well, maybe she was already kind of on her own path when we started coming down, because she's about 3 years older than me. Mm-hmm. And like I say, she still enjoys the wines. She actually lives back in Canada, so okay. I mentioned I have family still up there, and she's raising her family, and she actually looks after my family's charitable foundations up there. So it keeps her busy, and you know, it's nothing better to have a family member looking into all the companies, making sure all the dollars are going as far, you know, as they possibly can go to make things, to improve things for people. So she's got that gig, she's got two kids, and I think she really enjoys where she's at. I think it'd be great if she came down here at some point, you know, maybe in the future, but who knows? You know, everyone has their own sort of destiny, and I think it's nice to still have her up there. I really do like being able to go back home and see her and experience a lot of the things that we would do, you know, when we were kids, like just, you know, all the fun stuff that Alberta has to offer. So, yeah.
Since you brought up the charitable foundations, I know it's a part of your story, family story and mm-hmm. legacy, but why don't we quickly talk about what they are and mm-hmm. what type of charities they are and
sure.
what the significance is?
Well, out here in California, we just started working with the Napa Valley Community Foundation on setting up a fund that we could hopefully over time grow and use to support all sorts of different programs. But back in Canada, we have two charities. We have the Cliff Lady Family Foundation that my dad started, mm-hmm. and prior to that, my grandmother, Florence, she had a foundation that she created after my grandfather, so my dad's dad, passed away when he was young in a work site accident. Mm-hmm. And so she took a portion of the life insurance and put it into a foundation, and had just always helped it grow. And, you know, that was, I don't know, 30, 40 years ago now, I guess. And my sister now takes care of that since my grandmother has passed away. So both foundations, you know, really support. We have a lot of different causes that we support, but mm-hmm. a lot of it is focused on helping women, helping children, you know, people that are less fortunate and in need, sick kids, things like that. That's typically where a lot of the funds go, you know, supporting hospitals that are trying to build new centers, or if they need new technology, new machines to help give, you know, their patients better care. A lot of it goes towards those programs and things like that.
What was it like growing up in a family where, you know, there's such awareness of helping others, that this kind of generosity of spirit and, you know, opening your wallets to people that are in need, that's, again, not a common way of growing up. How did that influence you?
I think it just taught me that, you know, we are very lucky to be in the position we're in, and it's, you always want to stay humble about that, no matter what kind of success you have. Yeah. And you should always give back to your community. So, you know, being here in Napa now, that's something that I'm trying to do a lot more too, is attend a lot more of these events and meet the right people and find out who are the foundations that are in need and, you know, where can we help out and make the biggest difference. So I think that's more or less the feeling, you know, that you get, is just you realize that not everybody has as much as you do, and it's your sort of obligation to help people out.
What an interesting and, you know, fantastic family culture, because it permeates everything. I mean, you were born right. into it. It was started mm-hmm. by another generation, and mm-hmm. this was a norm for you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So the other value that I heard is work ethic. I mean, you came here mm-hmm. and you were tossed into
yeah.
the, you know, actual physical work, and, you know, you weren't just handed, you know, an opportunity to sit in the office and,
right.
and observe. So
yeah.
it really stood out to me that your dad clearly has those values.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a huge part of, you know, being here and working here, and, you know, looking back at all the different things I did over the years, from, again, you know, counting mm-hmm. clusters to
yeah.
working in the marketing department and working with accounting, and now being, you know, in sales and marketing kind of at the same time. I mean, when I came back and started here, like my official, you know, job in 2015, I felt like it was time. I felt like I'd earned it. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. I'd done all the things that I needed to do to get the job, and it wasn't just like, well, you know, he's got a great last name, so yeah, let's give him an opportunity. It was really like, I think I did whatever I could to prove that, you know, hey, I'm ready for this. At that point in time, it was a wholesale sales position. So I was looking after our wines and the sales of our wines in states around the country. And so, again, it was very like, throw them to the wolves, because I just had to get out there and learn how to, you know, sell wine at that level, which I hadn't necessarily done before. So I managed not to screw it up, luckily.
But you had such intimate knowledge of all the moving parts, sure, by then, so that gave you some degree of confidence. Mm-hmm. But marketing and branding and sales is a whole other beast. So
yeah,
the fact that you tackled it, that's pretty cool.
Well, it is an art form, and it's not something easily mastered. You know, it takes a long time to create those relationships and just to learn how to speak to people and, you know, alter your message one way or another to get the right information across to somebody. So it's a skill that you have to hone over a really long time. For some people it's more natural, for some it's a little bit more difficult, but I ultimately just wanted to, one, work for the family winery, mm-hmm, but two, I wanted to always, and I still look at this a lot, is I just want to provide, where can I provide the most value? Mm. And, you know, if it's being out on the road and giving people that sort of connection to the family, and then again, sharing that intimate experience I have with the wines and with the winery and the people at the winery, if that's the best thing for me to do, then that's what I'm going to go do. So I still do part of that. My role has shifted a little bit more, as there's a little bit more demand on me here locally and from, you know, other departments as well, but that's still the core of what I do out here, so it's good.
Who are some of your mentors? I would imagine your dad has to be one of them.
Yeah, my dad, for certain, and my dad, you know, he put together a team here that has been in place since sort of 2004, 2005, when, you know, things really started more or less ramping up. And that team has probably been the most, has probably mentored me the most. They're, mm-hmm, the ones who, you know, encouraged me to go back to business school and get my MBA. They're the ones that said, you know, you should really consider working somewhere outside of the winery, because, you know, I'd worked at other places, but not completely for a completely separate company. And even though I did work in wine, it was a completely different experience. So I think they've helped me along the way in terms of helping me sort of build my experience.
And kind of frame it.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. Yeah. And so I would say, you know, it's really the team here that's been the most impactful, I'd say, on my career and my direction. And, you know, even my friends here in Napa, I have friends here that have been here for their entire lives. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a couple of them are just really great people. They've introduced me to everybody, and they're also wine people who work really hard, and I've learned from them that, you know, I've learned the hustling element from them, like how to push for things and how to navigate a lot of these different experiences and I guess just things that situations you get into when you're out here in the wine business. They've kind of helped me learn how to navigate that. So I'm very lucky to have the people around me that I do.
Yeah, no, this is definitely a community.
Yes.
And a very tight-knit one in some regards, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And it's the funniest thing, because you have, again, a really tight-knit community, but a lot of competition at the same time.
Yeah.
A lot of competition. So you're helping each other out, but you're also competing with each other. And so it creates it's fun. At the end of the day, it's all fun. And I think if you have really solid fundamentals and you stick to them, I think that, you know, people appreciate what you're trying to accomplish at the end of the day. So
yeah,
it doesn't get too cutthroat.
Exactly. And, you know, the wines are all different. Fundamentally, mm-hmm, you have a high quality product, mm-hmm, your product. And yeah, you each have a story that, you know, has value and merit. So it's, I guess, who tells it more effectively, that may be the competitive part.
Yeah, yeah.
So you said you worked for a winery. May I ask which one that was?
So I worked for Molly Duker Wines out in McLaren Vale.
You mentioned you drink Australian wines. That's making
so sense. That was when I was 20, I think I was 24 years old or 23. And at that point in time, yeah, I drink a lot of Australian wines. I still do, not a lot, but yeah. I still really appreciate the wines of Australia. And for that, you know, it was, again, through sort of that mentorship program I was in, my dad's team was encouraging me, you know, working a harvest somewhere else might be a good thing to experience, to just see if maybe you want to go more into the winemaking side. And so, you know, we looked at a list of wineries and places where we had met people or had some sort of form of connection. And Molly Duker came up because it just seemed like not only, you know, making these wines that were really highly rated and highly adored, but also being a marketing powerhouse. And for me, that was really attractive because I had this interest in marketing and this interest in wine. And I thought, if I can absorb any of that or learn any of that, and I don't know if you've ever seen like Sparky give a speech. I know he's not at the winery anymore, but when he was there, his presentations were just like super enthusiastic, you know, and he was such a character that, you know, people just loved that and they connected with that instantly. And so, you know, there's things like that that I picked up, but it was just one of the funnest experiences of my life. Like the camaraderie I had with everybody that I worked with. And I mean, you know, you were on night shift, you were on day shift. It was a totally completely different way of making wine than we do here at Cliff Lady. And I love that I got that experience because to do the exact same thing somewhere else, I don't feel like I would have got as much out of it. So to see how these wines were made in a completely different form than we do, I think was really beneficial for me. And it was super fun.
I still think I have a couple of bags of Velvet Glove.
Oh, yeah.
That packaging. Yep. It was quite innovative at the time.
It's incredible.
But the wines are just so hedonistic.
Yeah, they are. They definitely represent a certain style. And you still see them all over the place. People still love them, even though Australian wine has had a little bit of more of a challenge out here in the U.S. lately. I mean, they're still one of the staple brands for the country. And, you know, I still keep in touch with the guys I worked with there. And they're out there selling wine and hustling. And, you know, I just appreciate the people and what they bring to the marketplace.
This is actually an interesting question that a lot of people in the trade have wrestled with in the last few years. And I'm sure you've gone to Wine Australia events. I mean, this question is very much still on deck. So from the marketing perspective, since that's your forte,
sure.
What do you think kind of messed up the Australian Shiraz market in the US?
I think sometimes when you lock yourself into one thing too much, it can come back and hurt you a little bit. So, you know, it's like if when a region decides like, okay, we're only going to be about Pinot Noir, we're only going to be about Shiraz, right? Mm-hmm. I think that there's pros to that and there's cons. And I think that so much Shiraz flooded the marketplace that was just not, you know, high enough quality, to the point where consumers just ended up getting, I don't know if it was palate fatigue or just overdone. And then I think you also had a lot of internal competition. You had a lot of wines coming out of the U.S. that could also sort of drive that style and fit that profile for people. So I'm not sure what the direction that it's going, but I think, you know, the Australian wines that I see out there now in the market are all the brands that I've appreciated for a really long time that have made great wine for a really long time, and the others that kind of just went for the trend and have maybe struggled, you know, they never necessarily had those solid founding principles. You know, and I think no matter where you're making wine, I mean, my philosophy is you should just try as hard as you can to stay true to where you're from, don't chase the trends, and just make wines that you enjoy and that you want to drink. And
that's pretty powerful.
That's what we try to do. So, yeah.
No, I think in the case of Australia, they experienced this meteoric rise. You know, brands were popping up. Remember Grateful Palate explosions, such like that, and everybody wanted them. And then there's all this kind of muddled, almost a confusion about the price points.
Right.
So if you were to correlate the ratings and the dollars. Sometimes you could get a 95-point wine for $20 or $30 Sometimes all of a sudden it became 100 or more. So I think the consumers were just so confused. And that did not help. But the instructive part that you highlighted is that the, you know, the famous houses that we all know and love, the Penfolds, the Henschke, I mean, that's historic. And many more, they have stayed the course. And they're not vulnerable to this kind of fluctuations. And that's a value that you hold, it sounds like.
You know, we, I think it's great when you hit a trend, when you're, you know, if people are, let's say they're really into Anderson Valley Pinot Noir, let's say that's the next trend and everybody is all about Anderson Valley Pinot Noir. I think that'll be great for Fell Wines, but, you know, we're not going to be like, well, they're really into, you know, super overripe, jammy Anderson Valley Pinot Noir, so let's start making that, you know, like, no, it's stick to what you think is the right expression of the properties that you work with. And hopefully, if that pendulum swings back the other way, at some point, hopefully you get consumers that are interested in drinking your wines. It's kind of like rosé, right? Like rosé had this huge meteoric rise. And I mean, I'm sure you've been drinking rosé for years and years and years. You know, I've been drinking rosé since I was probably 20, right? And it was always a nice wine to have, and it still is. But there's so much rosé now.
It's a glut, for sure.
I'm just like, you know what? I'm going to keep drinking the rosés that I remember drinking, the ones that I've had years ago. And I have no interest in trying new rosés because a lot of them just tend to fall short of what I think makes really good wine. And they're just really flashy, cool brands and this. And, you know, I don't mean to talk bad about rosé necessarily. I just feel like what we're talking about, that kind of pullback, at some point it's going to have to happen with rosé, and it's going to hurt a lot of these wineries that have, you know, put so much into just creating this pink colored beverage and then not really put any other thought into it.
No, I absolutely agree. I think chasing trends is a pretty precarious long-term strategy. In the immediate sense, it clearly works, especially if you put it in some pretty bottle and create some storyline around it. But at the end of the day, if that's your sole purpose, you're not creating a purposeful wine that is just, like you said, pink, then, you know, it's flash in the pan is much more likely to happen. So let's talk about wine since we're on the subject.
You want to taste? Let's get something in the glass.
So you have two quite distinctive brands. And one of them, you know, the physical presence is in Anderson Valley, and that brand is known for their Chardonnays and Pinot Noirs. And how many do you actually produce and fruit sources? Let's get into Fell. The brand is called Fell.
So Fell Wines is our Anderson Valley winery, named for my grandmother, Florence Elsie Lady. So it's her initials, named after my grandmother because she was the first winemaker in our family. And I kind of say that a little jokingly because, again, we're a Canadian family. So my grandmother used to make wine out of, you know, raspberries and cherries and just fruit wines. And that was how my dad, you know, learned that you could take fruit, ferment it, and turn it into something you could drink. So, you know, for him, he's the one, she's the one that sort of taught him that wine was a part of life. And he eventually, you know, caught this bug of Bordeaux throughout the 80s and 90s and collecting and all that. And that's what really influenced the Cliff Lady wines. But with Fell, we wanted to pay tribute to that. And so we named it after her. All the fruit for this project comes from the Anderson Valley. That is an area we identified as just a wonderful place to grow Pinot Noir and Chardonnay. And we initially got involved in the Anderson Valley in 2009 with another winery that has since changed names and is now what we call Fell Wines. But it's the same winemaker and the same vineyard sources that we've been working with since the very beginning. So I do have a map here, and for, for your listeners, if they want to see this map, they can find it on our website if they want to take a look and see what we're talking about. But with Fell, we like to work with some of the best vineyards in the Anderson Valley. We own one of them. That's the Savoy Vineyard. We acquired that vineyard in 2011. And that vineyard grows both Pinot Noir and Chardonnay. We also work with two vineyards in the south end. Savoy kind of sits in the middle, but Farrington and Donnelly Creek are in the south end. And the further south you get, the warmer it gets in the Anderson Valley. So you get a little bit more, you know, fruit expression coming off those sites. And the funny thing about Farrington and Donnelly Creek is they're right next door to each other, but they're actually quite different expressions of Pinot Noir.
The conclusion of this interview can be found in the next podcast, already available for your download. Thanks again for tuning in to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson,